From Springfield, this is State Week in Review, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
So we're going to subsidize a company so that they could sell their power out of state. That's supposed to be more important than social services, than higher education, than the budget and everything else.
The people of DeWitt County have been put through hell for the last 6 months, wondering, will they have a job?
The implicit assumption in the opponent's argument is that rates won't go up if we do nothing. And there's no evidence to support that. If we do nothing, the rates will go up.
What are we doing, you guys? What are we doing listening to this bill right now? I mean, we don't have a budget. And our so-called stopgap budget is just weeks away from expiring. And after that, we're back to no budget.
The Speaker and I have asked that we work on a budget. We've been willing to do that. We need to have the governor's cooperation. He has said he wants to talk about some other items, and we're talking about them.
The reforms are integral to the budget. That's the point that's being made here. Education reform, workers' comp reform, these reforms directly impact the budget.
Well, the veto session is complete. Lawmakers approved a big energy package to spare a couple of nuclear power plants and the jobs that go with them. But the week ends with more questions than answers, especially when it comes to the state's budget and where do we go from here. I'm Sean Crawford, and with me in Springfield is Charlie Wheeler, director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. In our Statehouse Bureau, Brian Mackey, Statehouse reporter for Illinois Public Radio. And our guest is Dan Petrella. He is the Springfield Bureau Chief for Lee Enterprises. Dan, it's good to have you back again.
Thanks for having me.
Brian and Dan, let me just begin with you on what did get accomplished this week. And I mentioned this energy deal. Let's start there.
Sure. It's a pretty big deal to our readers in the Clinton and Quad Cities area where these nuclear plants would have closed if the bill didn't pass. It's about 1,500 full-time jobs plus many more jobs that are seasonal when they shut down the plant for work and refueling and things like that. Lots of property tax revenue for school districts and things like that. So people in those communities are breathing a bit of a sigh of relief today, but there's also large companies in some of those areas that are questioning what it's going to mean for their power bills. And so that's sort of one of the unanswered questions going forward is, you know, there are caps put in to limit the increases on residential and business customers, but it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out over the next several years.
Yeah, we heard from large manufacturing companies and chemical companies in particular. They say their biggest single expense is electricity. And if you talk about, the governor likes to talk about the business climate in Illinois and the cost of workers' compensation and things like that. And several of the people who represent these companies said, you know, you could eliminate our workers' compensation costs entirely and it would still not make up for the hit we think we might take with the rise in electric costs in order to subsidize these, as Dan said, 1,500 jobs, 1,500 direct jobs in Clinton and the Quad Cities, as well as some ancillary jobs, contractors and local ice cream shops and gas station attendants and things like that.
I have a question for you guys downtown who have followed this much more closely than I have from afar. There's these widely varying estimates of the cost. The proponents say, oh, it'll be maybe 25 cents a month. And the opponents say, no, it's going to be more like $4 plus a month in increased charges to the people who are customers of ComEd and of Ameren, Illinois, which serves most of downstate Illinois. How do those estimates, how do the two sides get to such varying estimates? Are they using different kinds of math?
That's an excellent question, Charlie. I said that exact. I happened to be after one of these committee hearings earlier in the week. I was talking to a guy who's a top executive, a vice president of something or other at ComEd, as well as a woman who is a top official with AARP in Illinois, which is very opposed to this bill. She said, you know, we think there's going to be this huge increase. It's the largest rate increase in Illinois history. The ComEd guy says, no, that's not the case. And so I kind of, usually you interview people separately. I kind of asked them to I stopped them while they were both there. I said, can you explain this math? How is this? And the ComEd mm-hmm. guy said, well, you know, I don't really understand where they're coming from. And the AARP people said, you know, if it was only going to be 25 cents, that's something we could take a look at. 25, the captain had referred to on residential ComEd customers. It's supposed to be, there's this extremely complicated formula that is ultimately supposed to only be an effect of 25 cents per month on the average customer's bill, the portion of the bill that's related to the nuclear deal. And of course, as State Senator Don Harmon pointed out when the Senate committee was hearing testimony on this, he said, you know, my constituents are not the average customer. They are specific customers, and they don't pay average bills. They pay specific bills. And I, you know, they're going to come up to me in the grocery store and say, what the heck? Why is my bill going up? And I don't think a lot of lawmakers are going to really be able to explain it. I mean, Don Harmon's a pretty smart guy. He's pretty steeped in these issues. And he was really sort of, I don't think it was just a routine, but sounded, you know, like Columbo. I just don't get it. I don't understand. Can mm-hmm. you explain this? And the ComEd executives didn't seem to be able to explain how these, you know, in a way that lay people can understand how these formulas work.
And it's very complicated, and it involves, you know, many different factors of this formula. But it is going to be reviewed by the Illinois Commerce Commission annually to make sure that they're meeting these targets, and there's penalties and provisions built into the bill to prevent them from exceeding those caps. And as far as the differing opinions, you know, it's some of the proponents have said that the opponents are not factoring in the energy efficiency savings that will be produced through this bill, which is supposed to vastly increase what ComEd and Ameren downstate are investing in energy efficiency programs for customers. That's one of the discrepancies. There's also questions about one of the groups that's been circulating lots of the material in opposition to the bill. They don't disclose all of their backers, and the ComEd and Exelon folks believe that other energy companies who are opposed to this deal that would help Exelon are sort of backing that group, and that's the reason for its pretty fierce opposition.
Well, Dan, yeah, and I think that's one of one of the reasons you've seen environmental groups come on board with this, because they think this is a way of sort of perhaps continuing to marginalize coal and natural gas as alternative or as attractive, I should say, sources of energy. Because if you keep nuclear more viable and you subsidize wind and solar further, then that continues to marginalize carbon-based fuel sources like coal and natural gas, which are still a huge part of the electricity supply in Illinois. Right here in Springfield, which is a municipal power plant, they burn coal here. It's a big thing. But advocates from the environmental community are saying this is the biggest climate change positive thing happening in America right now.
Well, let me ask, too. I mean, when we look back on this, Exelon made a pretty bold move earlier in the year announcing that they were going to close those two plants if they didn't get legislation approved. While some called it a corporate bailout, it looks as though Exelon, the parent company of Commonwealth Edison, if it wasn't for that decision, that announcement that they made, this probably wouldn't have gone through.
No, that's correct. And also, I think there's you know, it should be noted that they didn't get everything that they wanted in this bill either. And had it been left the way that they would have liked, it probably wouldn't have passed either. They had gone for this complex rate change that would have shifted from charging users for how much energy they consume in a month to another complicated formula that would look at peak demand over half an hour increments for the month and then average that out. And you had groups like the Illinois Attorney General's Office and AARP, the Public Interest Research Group, coming out and saying that's going to be impossible for customers to understand and know how it's going to affect their bill next month. And once the governor's office got involved in the negotiations earlier this month, that part of the bill came out. And that was really, even according to some of the proponents like Senator Chapin Rose, who represents the Clinton plant, that was key to getting the bill passed.
Wasn't there also at one point some discussion about including a subsidy in there for some coal-fired plants owned by a different corporation, Dynegy?
Yeah, that's Dynegy downstate. The coal-fired plants were supposed to be in on this, and yet coal producers were not in on it. Those plants, as the director of the Illinois Coal Association pointed out at a hearing, those plants do not burn Illinois coal. And this is something that I think has been controversial about this legislation, is the legislature bent over backwards and spent hours and hours and committee hearings and negotiating over the Thanksgiving holiday. We were told they were negotiating every day but Thanksgiving itself, to save, as we said, 1,500 direct jobs and some indeterminate number of additional jobs in Clinton and the Quad Cities. Well, how many coal mining jobs have been lost in Illinois over the past decade or so? And the what was the appliance manufacturer in Galesburg? I was talking to somebody about this. And yeah, Maytag. And we just saw the Mitsubishi plant close in Bloomington. And so I think there are a lot of people who are justifiably asking, why is this suddenly the legislature's focus? I think there's an answer to that, and it has to do with who was behind this effort and their deep, deep ties in the political fundraising world in Illinois. But yeah.
Well, and the other thing about the Dynegy plants being included is that they would have lost support of all the environmental groups that got on board with this. And I think that was pretty key to sewing up support from some of the more progressive members of the Democratic Party in the Senate and in the House, who had been working on this clean energy jobs bill for several years. And it was kind of the marriage of that with what Exelon was looking for that helped, you know, get the ball over the goal line at the end of the day.
Well, the governor has indicated he plans to be on board with this, plans to sign this legislation. The governor did come out this week, and I guess was a surprise to some. He vetoed a package of legislation that would have provided some aid to Chicago public schools. Can one of you guys downtown give us sort of the breakdown of that?
Yeah, it was reported over the summer that part of the so-called stopgap budget that was passed at the end of June to just kind of keep Illinois barely afloat, higher education institutions, social service providers, the groups that had gone without funding during pretty much the entirety of the prior year, fiscal year at that point. This was part of the deal, in addition to sending money to those groups, was that Chicago Public Schools would get $215 million if and only if the legislature passed some sort of pension changes to state university employee pensions, which for full disclosure includes myself and Charlie and Sean on the panel today, state university employees, changes to those pension systems. That was integral to, and then the governor had agreed, if that happened, the governor had agreed to sign apparently this separate legislation that would have sent $215 million to the Chicago Public Schools, which themselves are having really deep financial problems, particularly related to their pensions. So fast forward to this week, the Senate president made a comment that, you know, it wasn't actually clear. He was asked a question about this, and there was some, I think, misunderstanding. He didn't quite understand what the reporter was asking about. And then eventually he said, well, this is not really a deal. I mean, we can still, you know, try to, if the, you know, the governor agreed to sign it, if we did pass this pension overhaul, but we're negotiating on that. I think we're really close on that. But I don't necessarily think it's a deal. And so there was some confusion about whether the Republicans certainly thought that the Senate president was going back on saying that there was an agreement. As we are standing outside the governor's office talking to the various political leaders, they happened to be meeting that morning. Within minutes, I think it's fair to say, we had gotten a fully drafted veto message from the governor's office saying, you know, suddenly this is terrible. We can't afford to do this, going back on it. And then
I was just going to jump in and say the Senate president's objection to this veto was that they had sent the bill to the governor so that he could act on it. You know, the 99th General Assembly is winding down, and they wanted to make sure that it was on his desk to be acted on before the legislature adjourns and the new legislature is seated. He did not have to act on it on Thursday. He had, I think, 30 days that he could have waited to sign the bill. And also, President Cullerton's spokesman later came out and said that the agreement was that the governor would sign the bill if they passed pension reform. There was never an agreement that the Senate or the House wouldn't try to override his veto if he vetoed the bill with a lack of a pension reform bill passing.
Yeah, and I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here. They used a parliamentary tactic to keep the bill from going to the, even though it had been acted on by the House and Senate much earlier this year, they used a parliamentary tactic to keep it from going to the governor's desk. And in the past, the Senate has felt like they had to remove those parliamentary holds before the end of the session. Now, they are coming back in January. Theoretically, the Senate president could have waited until that point to do this. Again, I feel like we're getting pretty deep into the weeds here. I think the bigger picture is there was perhaps a misunderstanding with the Senate president, if you're giving a generous interpretation of what he said. And pretty quickly, the governor seemed to have ready to go a veto message. And I think that there were even Republican Party emails going out about this later in the day. Well, the Senate comes back and does override the governor's veto. And now that money is for Chicago Public Schools is waiting to see if the House can do it, where, of course, they've had a much harder time overriding the governor's veto. Bottom line, not a good day for trust and cooperation. And I think the leaders kind of talking to each other and working together on things if they're communicating through veto messages here in Springfield instead of picking up the phone and asking, wait, did you really mean to say there's no deal? What are you talking about? We definitely had a deal.
And Charlie, you think that the governor mishandled this?
Well, I guess it depends on what you ascribe his motives to be. If I were in a position where I'm in a negotiation and it suddenly seems as though the person with whom I'm doing the negotiating has a different understanding of what our earlier agreement was and I wanted to continue in good faith, what I would say is, well, hang on for a second. I think there's a misunderstanding here and we're going to have to talk about this. And we'll have to get something worked out before the deadline on which I have to act on this bill, which, as Dan said, isn't for another month. I wouldn't immediately blast out this veto and say, okay, all bets are off. To me, that smacks of having bad faith.
And Dan, let me ask you to piggyback on what Brian was talking about. That doesn't foreshadow that there's a lot of cooperation going on at the Capitol right now.
No, it really doesn't. And there was even earlier in the day, it looked like the Exelon deal might be falling apart when some last-minute objections came up from the governor's office. But after many, many hours of many, many amendments going through, they finally fixed some of those problems. But yeah, the lack of trust is obviously pretty high right now. The leaders and the governor are supposed to meet over the weekend in Chicago to continue negotiating. So we'll see if that produces anything. On the CPS funding, you know, the House isn't scheduled to be back until January, which would be too late for them to act on that. And Speaker Madigan's spokesman, Steve Brown, told the Associated Press this morning that they don't have the votes to override that veto, which is why they adjourned yesterday without taking it up. So it really seems like more of the same. You know, the 31st of this month is the end of the stopgap budget, and it looks like we're going to be venturing into budgetless territory once again.
This is another example again of, I think, sort of a move that people who are used to watching Illinois government kind of scratch their heads at, because Senate President, if we step back and look at the divide, Governor Rauner and the Republicans say, we don't just want to talk about a budget. We think that these economic, pro-business, anti-union, and term limits changes that we want to put through are integral to the budget discussions. They have to be together. The Democrats are divided. You have House Speaker Madigan, who runs the House Democratic Caucus. He says, no, we just need to be talking about the budget. That's the number one problem facing Illinois. On the Senate side, Senate President Cullerton has said, you know, I'm willing to talk about these things with the governor. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can talk about the budget and we can talk about workers' compensation. We can talk about some of the governor's priorities. And for the administration to then just punch him in the nose like that and not give him any sort of benefit of the doubt on what he was saying or to ask him to clarify or anything. It just is an indication of the level of discourse or trust or however you want to say that around here. It was striking that that's their best chance of getting what they want done is to work with Senate President Cullerton and hope to isolate Speaker Madigan and eventually drag him along.
And the hope was that all along, that after the campaign season was over, that people would be able to come back together and work on some of these issues. But you've seen the Illinois Republican Party and the Rauner administration continue campaigning, and they've launched an attack on Speaker Madigan's leadership in the House, and they've launched a website, and they've had party operatives here at the Capitol all week taking video after these leaders' meetings and things like that, issuing press releases attacking individual legislators for whether they're going to support Madigan for leadership in the new General Assembly. So the campaign really has not ended.
To me, it's an example of bad faith. And again, I'll admit that my perspective is colored by the fact that I've watched for more than 20 years Republican governors work well with Democratic majorities in the legislature, including Speaker Madigan most of that time. And you didn't keep campaigning consistently and you didn't be attacking one of your negotiating partners at the same time you're trying to present yourself as, oh, I'm open to getting things done. And it occurred to me listening to the clip, Senator Redonio talked about what she thought was important, workers' compensation, education reform. And according to the reports that I've read, the governor's latest must-haves to show the business community that Illinois is turned a new page or whatever his rhetoric was, he wants to have a property tax freeze and he wants to have term limits. And so I'm scratching my head and saying, what in the world, if I'm a business leader, what kind of inspiration do I derive from the fact that, oh, in 2029, certain members of the legislature will be forced out because of this term limit plan?
I asked Leader Redonio that very question on Thursday after the leaders' meeting, actually, and her explanation was that it sends a message that Illinois is turning in a new direction and taxpayers will be given higher priority and that will be attractive to businesses and they'll be assured of some certainty and stability.
Term limits that are going to be effective in 2029? Senator Redonio actually said that?
Well, and I think that this just goes to the idea that a lot of, I think what Democrats suspect is, and if you look back at some of the governor's historic statements before he became the governor, when he was just citizen Bruce Rauner, is that what a lot of these are ultimately aimed at are ending the Democratic hold on power in Illinois. And that's why he supported a remap process or changing the way legislative districts are drawn that have been so favorable to Democrats this decade. And he has supported these term limits because I think he is playing a long game and he views House Speaker Madigan, accurately or inaccurately, as sort of the key obstruction for what he views Illinois policy should head in a more business-friendly, right-to-work, sort of southern state style, which is the ultimate goal of his turnaround agenda, even though those are not really necessarily items that are on the table in the current budget discussions. And I think that the Democrats say, we look at this, we look at the attacks on unions, specifically government employee unions, we look at the attacks on the speaker, we look at the way they're constantly going after politicians, not just during the several months before a campaign, but it's just become a permanent campaign here. And we think that this is ultimately aimed at weakening and if not sidelining the Democratic Party in Illinois.
Well, certainly the governor and Democrats could all, and Republican leaders as well, could all use a win. Is there something that's out there, and they could use one right now? I mean, is there something that, you know, we mentioned workers' compensation, for example, that seems to have some bipartisan support. Is there something like that that could break this logjam, at least in sort of a temporary way, maybe allowing a budget for the rest of this year? Does it seem as though that there's discussion going on and anything like that?
Well, I mean, I guess there's a way of looking at the fact that the Democrats and Republicans came together to allow a massive rate hike on electric utility customers is sort of a win. That was a moment of bipartisan cooperation. They're not really spinning it that way. That's why there's so much talk about these jobs and Clinton in the Quad Cities instead of this being a big rate hike. But, I mean, there is an example of bipartisan cooperation. And, yeah, certainly, as Charlie has pointed out in columns and on this show in the past, there have been numerous times that Democrats and Republicans have agreed to change the workers' compensation system, the tort law system. But it's not clear to me that anyone wants to give any ground right now, given that we are, as Charlie pointed out, already well into the 2018 election season, it seems.
Yeah, and
maybe the difference between, you know, back in the day was the negotiating parties, Republicans and Democrats, governors and legislators, looked for something where everybody could walk away as a winner. I could win and you could win. Now it seems as though it's not enough that I have a win, I also have to make sure that you are a loser.
Well, and there's just tremendous suspicion. One of the things the governor's office was putting out there on the last morning that the Exelon energy bill was up is that we think the House Speaker is put in some, what the term is escaping me, project labor agreements. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
prevailing wage.
Prevailing wage agreements, which basically says that even if you don't hire union employees, you have to pay a union scale to certain workers. And the administration was saying, we think the speaker put these in as a poison pill. Well, turns out those had been in the agreement going back several amendments. It's not like they had been added in the middle of the night just the night before or something. It just happens that the administration had not been engaged in the negotiating process until fairly late in the game and didn't seem to notice them until that point. And yet their initial reaction, whether genuine or as a matter of political messaging, was blame the speaker. Look, say that this is something nefarious. He's the one trying to do harm here.
And Dan, you mentioned that they're going to be meeting over the weekend, at least they're scheduled to. Are we getting any feeling as though there's something specific on the agenda for that, or is it just maybe for show?
Well, I think everybody will come into the meeting with a different agenda, as they seem to have been doing all along. If you believe sort of the way Senate President John Cullerton characterized things yesterday, perhaps they are getting pretty close on a pension agreement. I think I saw at one point yesterday that he said that the legislation even is pretty close to being able to be drafted. So if the whole blow up over the CPS funding doesn't screw that up, maybe we'll see them prepared to do something on that in early January.
And when we say pension, just so I don't leave people hanging with that, any idea what we might be talking about? Is it similar to what we saw before with some changes? Is it more of what the Senate president has pushed in the past?
Yeah, I think if people who have really followed this issue, it's this consideration model. And if I can possibly do a sort of thumbnail summary of this, it's that employees would have a choice. Either all of your future salary increases would not count towards your pensions, or if you do want to count your future salary increases, you get raises or get a better job in state government and get more pay. If you do want to count those towards your pensions, then you have to give up the automatic increase in your 3% cost of living increase that happens right now under current law. There are some people who think that is still not going to meet the Constitution. Some people on this panel, perhaps, who think that is still not going to meet the constitutional requirements for changing Illinois' pension systems. But that is kind of the broad outline of the possible pension change that we're talking about.
All right. And that's going to wrap up that part of our conversation. Let's go to our notes from the field. And Brian, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I'm reading Sun-Times is reporting just this Friday morning that a group of Democratic state representatives have filed a lawsuit against outgoing Illinois Comptroller Leslie Munger, trying to get their pay speeded up. Munger has deprioritized legislator pay, put him in the back of the line with all the other Illinois paychecks that go out to companies and vendors, and a group of lawmakers are suing. They have not been paid since June.
Dan?
One bill that actually got passed during the veto session that flew a little bit under the radar was blocking changes that the Rauner administration wants to make to overtime rules for people who take care of people with disabilities in their homes. This is going through the administrative rule process right now, but this law that was just passed would prevent the administration from being able to make those changes, although I'm sure it will be vetoed when it reaches the governor's desk.
And Charlie.
Well, we've been talking about the stopgap budget and kind of looking at the short term. Institute of Government and Public Affairs over at the U of I in Champaign-Urbana has a fiscal futures project, and they released a very sobering analysis by Richard Dye and David Merriman showing that even if we make deep cuts, even if we raise taxes, even if we put in all kinds of economies, we expand our tax base and increase our economic growth, we're basically looking at very tough times for at least a decade. Their conclusion is, we see no plausible path to sustained fiscal stability without significant and broad-based sacrifice.
That's a positive way to end today's show.
Yeah.
Our panel this week, Brian Mackey, Charlie Wheeler, and Lee Enterprises' Dan Petrella. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.